From the KTOO newsroom in Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumry. A 2017 tugboat sinking in Sitka has resulted in a settlement of over $1 million from the National Pollution Fund Center. The amount of fuel spilled from the sunken tug, while not large, came at a critical time in the life cycle of herring in Sitka Sound. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The tugboat Powhatan sank at its moorings in Stargavin Bay, just north of Sitka, on April 17, 2017. Sinkings aren't uncommon in Sitka, and it wasn't until a few days later that the State Department of Environmental Conservation issued a situation report, and residents learned this was unexpectedly bad. The Powhatan, which we at KCAW were still learning to pronounce, have been dragged by currents into deep water with over 300 gallons of fuel on board. Here's what Sitkins heard on the news.
The 81-foot tugboat Powhatan, owned by Samson Tug and Barge, sank at its dock in Stargavin Bay. The tug then slid under the pier and drifted about 300 yards offshore, where it was located by divers from Hanson Maritime Company.
The tug's owner, the DEC, the Coast Guard, and SEAPRO, the Southeast Alaska Petroleum Response Organization, all responded, deployed boom, and eventually defueled the Powhatan. But by then, the damage had been done.
At that emergent life stage, it does not take very much oil to have an injury to herring.
Erica Ammon is a biologist with the National Marine Fisheries Service and one of the co-authors of the Final Damage Assessment and Restoration Plan for the Tug Powhatan Oil Spill. In March, the news in Sitka is all about herring and their eggs, the commercial sac roe fishery, the subsistence roe on hemlock harvest. In April, after everyone, marine mammal, fish, human, bird, has had their fill of eggs, the herring larvae hatch. That's right, when the Powhatan sank, and that's why it was so serious, although not nearly as large as a famous blowout in the Gulf of Mexico 7 years earlier.
It wasn't that the spill was, like, incredibly large. You know, it wasn't a deep water horizon or anything like that. But the timing of it and the location of it was what really struck us as something that was important for us to pay attention to and to have some kind of, you know, restoration for.
Using data from herring spawn surveys conducted that spring by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, along with aerial photographs of the extent of the visible oil sheen, plus research on the susceptibility of herring larvae to diesel fuel, Ammon's team estimated that 25.4 billion juvenile herring had died in the spill. That kind of precision was possible, Ammon says, because of the Sitka Sound Science Center, which under then-research director Tori O'Connell had joined the effort to learn how badly herring had been affected.
That's what we hope to be as a local science center, is a responsive local agency that can respond to need when it arises.
Lauren Bell is the current research director at the Sitka Sound Science Center, which will play a large role in the restoration plan for the Powhatan spill. After the tug's owner reached the limits of liability for the accident, the National Marine Fisheries Service applied to the Oil Spill Liability Trust, and this past June settled for $1.3 million. The lion's share of that money will be divided between two projects, for increased shellfish monitoring on Stargavin Beach by the Sitka tribe, and for marine debris cleanup on beaches where herring commonly spawn. The Science Center already has the logistics in place and cleans beaches every year. Bell says removing marine debris is advantageous for herring.
It's helping with returning natural sediment flow in these habitats and not interfering with the permeability of those sediments. So my understanding is that if you have marine debris in an environment, that it can stress the seaweeds and seagrasses that are in the area, and all that abrasion and smothering can be bad news for herring.
The downside of the restoration plan is that beach cleanup is temporary. Most of the marine debris in Sitka Sound originates elsewhere and is an ongoing problem. Erica Ammon says the restoration plan is not a magic bullet to forever protect herring. Rather, it's short-term and attainable by design.
We aren't assuming that, we cleaned this and we can walk away and that it will be restored forever. We have a very limited timeline as far as what we think our restoration benefits will be from a single marine debris cleanup.
The Powhatan was on the bottom of Starrigavin Bay for almost 2 months before crews managed to bring it up with an enormous crane in the middle of June 2017.
Last week, salvage crews raised the Powhatan and placed it aboard a barge for a ride south to a Seattle scrapyard.
That would be the end of the story, except in Sitka Sound, the story never ends. Just last year, during the height of the herring spawn in March, yet another ocean-going tug, the Western Mariner, ran aground in Olga Strait, just a few miles from where the Powhatan went down. Because herring eggs are less vulnerable than larvae, the Western Mariner fuel spill may prove less harmful overall. Erica Ammon says she's working to find out. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Two Tennessee hikers who survived more than a week in the woods near Chena Hot Springs, east of Fairbanks, are back home, reflecting on what happened and grateful for search and rescue personnel. KUAC's Dan Bross spoke to one of the hikers about their experience.
50-year-old Jonas Baer and longtime friend and travel partner 37-year-old Cynthia Hovsepian set out for a day hike from Chena Hot Springs Resort on August 10th.
By simple bad choices, a three-hour hike that led to an eight-day survival.
Baer says they followed a loop trail that took them into a burn area where they lost the path.
You can't tell between the burn marks and the actual trail.
He says they became disoriented and ended up hiking through jumbles of fallen trees and marshy tussocks.
Giant pillows that as soon as you took a step in, you had to take all the energy just to pull your foot back out to step up again. This is exhausting.
Baer says they ate the few snacks they carried by Saturday, August 12th, and were cautious about eating wild berries, but the primary issue was thirst.
Food never was an issue. We never thought about it. We never dealt with it. We never felt the hunger. We just wanted to keep moving. But water was so, we just seemed like we could not drink enough water. We were so thirsty all the time.
Baer says they stayed primarily along a creek for access to water, but made forays away from it to look for a way out. He says they built fires to warm up and get dry following frequent rains.
We made a camp over the 8 days, four different places, to reassess what we had to do. We ran across a couple bears and nothing was really scary for us, but you know, we were very vigilant about our surroundings all through the night. You can't sleep. You have to keep the fire going. You just take little breaks here and there and you just keep pushing.
Baer regrets not bringing their cell phones or some other communication or signaling device. He calculates they were no more than about 6 miles from the resort at any time and says they saw search aircraft.
They were just miles away in another range, and there's no way we could ever get to them. So we made a smog fire, tried to smoke them out. Nothing would seem to work.
By the night of Thursday, August 17th, Baer says they were weak and becoming hypothermic.
We knew, like, if we didn't get out of there on our own accord, we were dead.
He says Hovsepian, who is visually impaired, was faring worse.
She's physically done. She can't see. She can't climb. So I made her a huge safe area with firewood backup. I said, I'll be back in 5 hours.
That was Friday the 18th. Baer says he hiked north.
We have a general idea of about 20% chance it has to be this way because we eliminated all the other options at this point.
Baer says he eventually found a trail, ran into two people walking, and made it back to the hot springs.
There's all these people here, and then my dad was there from Ohio. He flew in on Wednesday just to help with the search. He didn't even recognize me. And that's probably the picture a lot of people have seen on the media. He is in shock, and I am in shock.
Baer says he guided law enforcement, military, and search and rescue personnel who used a helicopter and ATV to find and bring Hovsepian back to Chena Hot Springs. He thanks everyone who participated in the week-long search effort.
There's so many people, and you got to understand, we were dazed and confused Friday night, and I could not interact enough with everyone to get everybody's names and all that and faces, but these people have to be recognized.
Baer and Hovsepian spent the weekend recovering before flying home to Tennessee Sunday night. He says Alaska is the 50th state they've visited together. Getting lost prevented them from seeing some other parts of the state, and he says they plan to come back. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Alaska Department of Public Safety and the Anchorage Police Department announced Tuesday that they are publishing new quarterly reports specifically about missing Indigenous people. Alaska has a particularly high case count of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Federal, state, tribal, and grassroots interests have all pushed to identify why and to improve safety in Indigenous communities. Most of the information in this new report comes from existing public missing persons data sets, but it does include a new data point about the circumstances around each unresolved disappearance. The agency's analysts had to go individually through all 280 cases of missing people who are Indigenous or of unknown race. The analysts coded the circumstances into one of four broad categories, like environmental events, non-suspicious disappearances, and suspicious or unknown categories. You're listening to KTOO.